Solitaire Rose Radio, episode 58, an interview with Mike Allred. Mike Allred has been working in comics since about 1989, 1990, and we go into how he started working in comics. I also talk a little about how I first discovered his work. Reading those first stories in a magazine called Graphic Music, I was struck by his art style and his stories, which at once seemed fresh and new, but retro. And I have followed his work since. So many highlights. Madman. Superman Madman Hullabaloo. One of my favorite crossovers ever. His work at Marvel. His work at DC. All of the stuff. We talk a lot about it. But we also talk about how he sort of came into comics. And how he doesn't just do comics. He makes movies. He makes record albums. He's got a band. In a lot of ways, he's a true Renaissance man, and I really think you'll find this interview interesting. So rather than me talk for a long time, we'll just get right into it.
I want to say that I actually first read your work in a graphic novel called Graphic Music, I think it was called. And I don't know, was that through Slave Labor or Caliber?
The first thing of mine ever published was a graphic novel called Dead Air. And then I did three issues of an anthology title of my own making called Graphique Musique. We were living in Europe at the time, and the title was inspired by two stores I saw in Paris. One was a music store and one was an art store. And I thought, that's the perfect way to describe the comic book. It's graphic music. And I just went the pretentious route initially with Graphique Musique, and all of that. Dead Air, my first graphic novel, then the three 48-page issue each of Graphique Musique. That was all Slave Labor graphics.
Okay.
And then around that time, I was working on what was to be a 12-issue series for Kimiko, a company that no longer exists because they went bankrupt. But
yes.
we were going to do a 12-issue series called Jaguar Stories. And on the strength of that, I was able to quit my broadcasting job in Europe and move back to the States, which was the goal. And thinking that I'd have 12 months to establish a comic book career, Laura was convinced that it was worth rolling the dice, and she got behind me wanting to make that career change. But because Kimiko did go Chapter 11, that switched things up really quickly. And so I then got an offer from Caliber to relaunch Graphic Music in color. And so four issues of Graphic Music. So then this time it was spelled phonetically, and like Graphic Music.
That's the one I read.
Okay, then you saw the Caliber series.
Yes.
And the first issue of that series and one shot also from Caliber called Creatures of the Id were the first appearances of Frank Einstein, who later became Madman. So that's pretty much the seeds of my career right there.
Although you dropped something very interesting in there. You were overseas working in radio.
Television,
how
actually.
Okay.
Yeah, I was a TV reporter. Did a magazine show for AFRTS, which that and AFN are the English language military-based broadcasting networks. So you'll often hear when you meet foreigners and they're familiar with American television and culture, a lot of times it's through the Armed Forces Network or AFRTS was through the Air Force, which is who I worked for. So AFRTS, Armed Forces or American Forces or Air Force Radio and Television Service.
And how did you get from somewhere in the U.S. to that job?
Well, in college, art was my major, and it was actually, and I'd been an artist my whole life. From my earliest memories were being surrounded by comic books, wanting to make my own comics, and our parents encouraged us to be artistic. We always had drawing tools and paints and crayons and paper, and Dad had a drawing table, and so it was always a part of us, and we had the Andrew Loomis instructional books, and we'd like trace the figures in there and then draw superhero costumes on the figures, and so it was always a part of my life. And then going through school, I was always that kid in the back of the class who, you know, everybody, draw this for me and draw this for me. So I was always the artist guy. And then junior high, my art class, my instructor actually let me make my own assignments, and I had a big easel of, you know, my own station off in the corner, and it just really strange that way. So it just felt like, well, this is my path. And then it was actually in college where I panicked, because I, all of a sudden, it became very unclear to me how to make a living at being an artist. And one of the earliest friends in my life who lived across the street from me, a kid named Eric Warden, his dad actually owned a couple radio stations in town where I grew up, and in Oregon, Roseburg, Oregon. And then he started working for there and became an extremely talented broadcaster. You'll hear his voice on a lot of national commercials even today, Eric Warden. So he's like a very successful person, but his path was kind of cleared for him his entire life, because he was very interested in what his dad had, the path that was laid out for him. And Eric had the skills and the ambition to, you know, make it work for him. So when I was in college, there was a broadcasting course, and there was a college radio station. And so I started with that. And then they had television courses. And then so the next summer, I ended up working with Eric at his family's radio station and really enjoyed it. And so then when I went back to school, I switched my major to broadcasting, because, again, I could not figure out. Like, I had great art instructors, but there was no one was telling me, and this is how you get a job for this, and this is how you get a job for that. And working in the comic book business, I didn't know if that would ever be something that, I was always under the impression that you had to move to New York and try to get into, I still was under the impression that Marvel and DC, was just one big open office with drawing tables and rows of people just producing artwork and writers throwing, you know, script pages at them. And so somewhere along the line, I didn't see how it was practical to pursue a career in, you know, making comic books. But anyway, just to quickly tie up this, working at the radio station, So then, Laura and I have been together since we were 18. I'm 6 days older than her, and we got married, and I think after 2 years, she was pregnant with our first child. And so at the radio station, Air Force recruiter came in and said, I think he might have even met Laura or saw that she was pregnant, or in any case, he said, hey, you know, you can do that and see the world and, you know, free babies. And 'cause that was a concern, the medical bills for having a child and whatnot. And,
oh, yeah.
And so I started to seriously consider that. And so it just kind of went for it and went through that broadcasting school and just sailed through to where I ended up. My first job was on the faculty at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, teaching television production to the cadets there, and who they had their own TV station and they put on their own newscast, and we taught them how to do everything. So from there, I learned every aspect of broadcasting. I already knew radio, had some television experience, but then through the broadcasting school and then at the Air Force Academy, just became adept at everything, you know, where you on location shooting, studio shooting, audio, video, effects, everything. So you're just completely well-rounded, lighting, you know how absolutely everything works. And then after a few years there, I got it to Rammstein, Germany, and for 2 years there worked this magazine program. And the first job I did getting there was right before I arrived. There was an air show, and these two Italian jets collided midair, and one of the jets plowed right into the crowd.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yes, it was worldwide news. Well, the footage that you saw was footage that I gathered from this was the late 80s, and home video was becoming more accessible to where everybody had, you know, cameras. So there were multiple views of this horrible event, and we gathered that footage to send out to news outlets, you know, worldwide. And so the first story I did was on one of these helicopter rescue workers. And then the last story I did before taking the swing at a full-time comic book career was on East German refugees who all of a sudden just there was this mass exodus, people risking jumping the wall and you know, running into the West. And we went to a contingency center at a hospital where these people that had escaped were hoping to find employment and you know, prosperity in the West. And that was amazing to you know, hearing these stories from these people and how the conditions had just all of a sudden gotten really horrific and they had nothing to lose to where go ahead, shoot me in the back. I'm going to take my chances. And you saw this take place. And then of course, soon after, in fact, right before we left, to get back to the States, the wall came down and, I actually, grabbed up pieces of the Berlin Wall, and sent some home, like Matt Wagner, who had reached out to me, because by this point, some of my work was being seen in solicitation distribution catalogs. And Matt had sent me a postcard. He was actually living in San Jose at the time, which is where Slave Labor Graphics is. And Dan Vado, the publisher, still has a comic book store, and that's where Matt got his comics. So he was seeing the stuff that I was sending to Dan. And liked it, so he like sent a postcard and reached out and gave me his phone number and everything, and we've since become great friends. And now he lives in Portland, and we're in a book club together. It was just weird how this all kind of went down. But Matt's one of the few people that got one of these pieces of the Berlin Wall, and he has one of the pieces that has graffiti on it. I had all of these other pieces of the wall that we were going to take back with us. And there were professional movers that would box up all your stuff. And so there were these rocks, you know. As far as the movers were concerned, there were chunks of asbestos in our apartment, and they just threw them away. So they were telling us, you don't want this, you can't have this, and so okay, fine. So, but the piece that Matt has is more of like a, it's like a rock that was in the wall and had like on the outside of the wall and has paint on it. So hopefully it's not too dangerous. But yeah, that so, and that was
if we
that
don't
was
get made
for
you, it's your fault. You're saying.
But that's my broadcasting career. So radio to television instruction at the Everest Academy, and then as an actual reporter in Europe, and then as of January 1990, I've been a full-time comic book maker.
Well, you've kind of switched between the two because you've also made film,
yeah,
and involved in film. Do you think that your time working in television has influenced your art? Because your art, to me, always has seemed very kinetic and very cinematic. Do you think that working in television and editing and learning all those things informed your art style?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I had no idea there was any such thing as a film school, for instance. If I were to do everything over again, giving and not knowing how to get into the comic book industry, which is exactly where I want to be, I'll preface that. But I would have gone to film school, and that would have been the course I would have laid out for myself to be, you know, a director and make movies. And because I'm a huge film nut, my brain is just full of useless pop culture information with music and movies, television, comic books. And but I've just, through a series of happy accidents, meeting the right people and having the right influences and inspiration, I've wound up exactly where I want to be. And through confirming that by making my own movies and having a band and making albums and doing live shows and touring around a little bit, what I've come to find is my happy place is at my drawing board, and telling stories in the most efficient way possible. And that's what the comic book industry is for me. So I love collaborations. I love getting out there. I love making movies. You know, I've been on set with Kevin Smith and Robert Rodriguez. In fact, spent years with Robert Rodriguez and did a lot of fun stuff on several of his films. And if you were to tell me, here you go, here's your support system, you can make movies for the rest of your life, I might dive into that. But there's something very liberating about knowing that all of the tools I need to tell the story I want to tell are right in front of me, with just, you know, a piece of paper, a pencil, a brush and some ink, you know, and not having to go anywhere, not having to travel anywhere, not having to get permission from anybody. And so I always have that very pure creative outlet at my fingertips. And then every once in a while I'll do stuff like iZombie has been a wonderful surprise. You know, and again, working with filmmakers I've been able to meet and be friends with and collaborate with. And now, the collaborations I do with comics, where I'm working with these great writers, and now I'm working with Dan Slott. Of course, I've worked with and co-created with Sean Simon and Chris Roberson and Matt Fraction and my brother Lee, who I probably wouldn't even know what a comic book was if it wasn't for him and the great taste that he has and I was born into. So comics is exactly where I want to be. And again, like with the music too, I love playing live. I love making and recording music. I'm very proud of the two albums, which are both double albums, by the way, that we've made, and we've been working on a third for several years now. But my priority is making comic books, and I don't have to haul around a bunch of, you know, we're not successful enough that I can hire roadies and, you know, have everything, you know, hauled out and hooked up and plugged in and then just come out on stage. We don't have that luxury. So it's there's that burden, you know, shoving everything into a van and getting to your gig. And all of that stuff I'm not keen on. I just want to create, I want, you know, perform or make something that didn't exist before. And comic books is the absolute favorite place for me to do that. And so that's what I do. But yeah, the short answer is yes, television, film, all of that does have a huge influence on how I tell a story in a comic book. I do want it to have that energy, that cinematic, kinetic quality. And so all of these pop culture entities, which are very important to me, all play together. In fact, when I record music or have made films, the comic book influences are in there as well. They all intersect. They all play off each other, and they all have a rhythm. And like a comic book has a musical rhythm. Again, going back to graphic music, how many panels you use to tell an action or an event. Do you cut from one day to the next, or do you take a whole page to play out 10 seconds, you know, you can create slow motion by multiple panels. You're playing with time. You're deciding you're telling readers, these are the moments in time that I want you to see when you're reading these words to tell this story. And all of that is very musical and it has pace and editing the way a film would. So all of these things are connected and tied together as far as I'm concerned, and they all interact and influence each other.
One of the things that I found very interesting is, you know, I've been following your career for quite a while. You were almost kind of the newest person when the group, I don't even know what to really call it, but Dark Horse had legends.
Oh, yeah, legends, yeah.
And you've got John Byrne and Frank Miller and Mike Mignola, and you're almost kind of the new kid on the block in that group.
Oh, very much
so. Was it intimidating being invited in, or did it feel very welcoming?
It was both. Frank Miller was actually the one to call me up and told me that everybody had voted and unanimously agreed to invite me. And I'd met most of them, and you know, so yeah, I mean, holy cow, Dave Gibbons, Jeff Darrow, Art Adams, you know, in addition to the ones you mentioned. And these guys are in fact legends and have established careers, and I had just barely kind of blown up with Madman. So I didn't have a history to really, and I'm evaluating myself this way. So in the intimidation side of the answer to your question, I felt, you know, I'm not worried of that whole thing. And, so when Frank first made the offer, I actually said, wow, that's amazing, and that's so flattering. Do you mind if I talk to Laura and get back to you? Can I call you tomorrow? And he's like, oh, sure, of course. And he probably thought, well, you jerk. I mean, you should like, are you a fool? And I was being foolish, but I was also kind of in a panic. And Laura is my other half in every way. And I needed to assess what this meant. And then went to Laura and said, you won't believe what just happened. And I don't even think I finished my sentence. She said, get back on the phone and call Frank back and tell him absolutely yes, thank you very much, which I did. And, you know, I apologize. Sorry for being hesitant. I'm not, you know, it's not an ego thing. I just want to make sure that you won't be embarrassed by having me be a part of this otherwise, you know, phenomenal group that deserves the name Legend. And he was like, oh no, we're all really excited about your work. And they wanted that new blood in there. And, And from my point of view, I benefited more than anybody from that imprint, because we then did a tour for, you know, the summer season, going to all the different shows. And I remember at one, I was signing prints in a VIP room, and Aerosmith came in with their family. They had done a comic book with Valiant, I think, at the time. And so I just remember all these really cool events that were happening. And because I was just kind of riding this magic carpet with these other guys, and so of course we're there, and we'd be at tables and whatnot, and be in a row there, and we'd have these free things that we could sign for everybody, which helps not being too embarrassed when no one's bringing books for me to sign. But it benefited, because, you know, there'd be this long line of people that would go down the table, and they'd have specific things for their favorite artists that they would want signed. But they would, because we were in a line on this table, everybody would be meeting us and talking with each of us. And so, and this is where it benefited, where each other's fan base was being exposed to each of our work that didn't otherwise share that fan base. You know, and everybody, like even the super popular, you know, successful guys, they were also benefiting from this mingling, this interaction with their peers' fans who came to see and meet them. And they would have these nifty little things that we could all give to everybody. But, of course, I was the guy that nobody knew. But if you wanted to be introduced to a bunch of people under the best circumstances possible, this was it. So that was huge for me, and I am forever in the debt of those seven guys to make me number eight, because it was just huge for me. It really was this giant, you know, boost in my career, and so that was 94, and so 4 years into my career, I just got this huge leg up. And what can I say? Thank you. Those guys were phenomenal. I love them all to pieces, and I'd do anything for any one of them.
And being exposed to your style, you had a style that was it was retro, but it felt new. And I wanted to ask what artists influenced you, and to kind of go off that a little bit, one of the things that I always think helped your art feel new is your characters dressed almost a little ahead of modern fashion. Mm. You know, I would see people dressed in Mad Men, and then that summer in Uptown Minneapolis, oh, there are people wearing those fashion styles. There are people dressed like that. So where did you pull your art influences from? Who were the artists that you looked at and went, these are the guys who kind of are putting things in my head?
It's weird. I kind of fell away. So comic books were ever present in my childhood. I hit puberty and they kind of fell away. In fact, there was a very specific moment when they killed off Gwen Stacy in Spider-Man. I was a regular Spider-Man reader. I'd hit the drugstore and make sure I got Spider-Man every month. And I had a huge crush on Gwen Stacy, and when she was killed, it absolutely devastated me on a real world level. And I couldn't bring myself to read the book anymore. I pretty much quit comics cold turkey at that point. It really was traumatic. And so I spent my paper route money buying record albums at that point. And so the things that became interested in with art, and it was largely why I stopped thinking about, you know, it as any kind of career or anything too. Became more interested in like commercial art and wanting to design record album covers and that sort of thing. So that's where a lot of these design sensibilities came in, and, you know, interest in fashion or pop culture in general, where fashion and film and everything all intersects. And so always kind of looking at what's new and exciting and that kind of thing, which rock and roll always does. or did anyway. I don't see rock isn't as exciting as it used to be when I was coming up. But and there's a few bands I really love, but it's rare that any new band will get me excited. But they exist. They're out there. So that's where I was with that. So when I came back to comics, a friend, Charlie Custis, at the Air Force Academy, we were big movie nuts and we'd go to the movies and stuff. And he was a huge comic book fan and he saw that I was an artist. I was always sculpting or painting, you know, I was always making something. And he was like, and then I started writing a screenplay called Dead Air. And he was like, man, you should make that a comic book. And around the same time, Steve Siegel, who is now he's one of the Man of Action group that created Ben 10 and they created Big Hero 6. He had just published his first comic book, which was called Kafka. And at this and he's from Colorado Springs. His dad used to work at the Air Force Academy, and so Charlie and I are at the comic book store and Charlie's turning me, you know, you got to get this and you got to look at that. And he's showing me all these different books. And at the comic shop is Steve Siegel signing, you know, he's in the back just grabbing his books off the shelf and signing them. So, you know, to help sell them better, quicker, because they're signed, man. And we're introduced to Steve and then Steve quickly became one of the most important people in my life and started kind of telling me about, and he's a writer, and of course he's the guy that I then ended up co-creating Jaguar Stories with, which never came out. But with Charlie, he had this massive comic book collection, and for me, it was mad love. It was like rediscovering a part of myself that I had ignored and abandoned for a few years. And this was the first time I saw comic book stores, by the way, which Colorado Springs had several. Between Colorado Springs and Denver, it was like discovering a vein of gold, you know, is like, wow. And in my childhood, I would have, you know, a few issues of the Legion of Superheroes. I'd have a big chunk of Fantastic Four. I'd have a big, you know, I'd have some Silver Surfer comics and, but I didn't have a whole run of anything. And, you know, if you didn't get it at the drugstore, that was it. You had your chance. So all of a sudden, I have money and comic book stores with everything I always wish I had. And, so I just went nuts and, bought the comics that I loved when I was a kid, filled in all the holes. Like I had a complete run of Jack Kirby comics eventually, except for the first two, I never got a Fantastic Four number one or two, but from like 3 to 107, I had every Fantastic Four comic and similar with the X-Men and Daredevil and, you know, on and on. So I'm like, and it's just this crash course. And so I'm reading, one of the things Charlie gave me, which was new at the time, was The Dark Knight Returns. And to lock in the exact time of this, Watchmen still had like two issues to go in its regular, 12 issue run. So we're talking late, you know, mid to late 80s here when all this
86,
stuff.
86, 87.
There you go. So, and I'm just getting everything. And Laura's like watching these stacks and stacks. And all of a sudden boxes are coming into the house and it was just insane how I just was just buying everything I could. And I would make these clay, like life-size busts and stuff. And one of the comic book stores would trade me for like my sculptures. And I did an Adam West Batman head at the time. I did one guy wanted a Beaker statue of all things of the Muppets.
Yeah.
Which is the easiest sculpture you could ever make. It's just kind of a cylinder with a circle for a nose. But I got hundreds and hundreds of dollars worth of comic books with stuff like that and would just this and I want this and this. It was like a dream come true, with, you know, imagining just having access to all of this stuff. And so because of that, I tapped into this childhood love of this stuff I remember as a kid, and that became the, you know, my biggest influences. There was the only comics that I got between that era and my childhood was over a summer when I found every Barry Smith Conan in a used bookstore and picked those up. And so Barry Smith, and if you see those issues, Barry Smith was a very crude Jack Kirby wannabe when he was first working for Marvel.
Yeah.
And when you look at the Conan issues he did, and he did a lot of stuff, X-Men, Daredevil, Avengers, but on Conan, you saw this over like a 2-3 year period, he just burst into this artiste. And it was just, it's a beautiful thing to watch. And I keep those comics on a spinner rack in my studio. They're just a major touchstone for me. And to see this artist grow into his own unique, exciting, style. And so anyway, Barry Smith was always huge for me, in this period. And he kind of had that rock and roll record album kind of vibe to him too. And I would buy his prints and all that stuff. So in that, space of 10 years or so, I don't remember exactly when Gwen Stacy was killed, but Barry Smith was the only stuff I really got excited about. And I bought, I would buy some other Conan comics too. So I always liked John Buscema. But in this crash course period in the late 80s to the early 90s, and reading the Comics Journal and reading books about comics, I was really drawn to the greats that, you know, built the industry. And so I just drank in everything on EC Comics. I picked up that whole, you know, slipcase library. So Johnny Craig and Bernie Krigstein and Frank Frazetta, so I just take all that stuff in, and of course Jack Kirby and John Romita and Steve Ditko and Jim Steranko, all of these great artists became my biggest inspirations. And then around the same time, Epic started releasing these Mobius books. And so Mobius just like hit me between the eyes and let me again. So I was constantly having something to get really excited about. And so I think it's this mixture of them, but the book that really turned me from fan to participant was Love and Rockets. Steve Siegel, one of the books that Charlie Custis gave me was Mr. X, and the first four issues were done by the Hernandez brothers. And then becoming friends with Steve Siegel, he's like, oh, if you like Mr. X, you will love Love and Rockets, where they created their own characters and, like, you know, they do everything and whatever they want. And so I fell into Love and Rockets, and it's true. And that's where I fell in love with the anthology idea, where you can tell any story you want, any characters, switch it up, you know, whenever you want. If get done with this storyline, then hey, then tell a vampire story. You're done with the vampire story, tell a big robot story. You know, just whatever you want to do under that title. And that's what Love and Rockets was for me. And just watching these brothers just have the best time, no rules, doing exactly what they want and beautifully. And that was published by Fantagraphics, and that then, you know, turned me on to Dan Klaus's stuff. I discovered Yummy Fur, where Chester Brown was just doing this insane, disgusting stuff that was just addictive, that pulled me into these really weird, bizarre places. And so I was just drinking everything in. And I think it's a mix of all the classic stuff and the new, exciting stuff. That and then hopefully a little bit of me that's actually unique, and just put it in a blender, and that's what I think what became my style, kind of this fashion forward retro thing.
Well, that's one of the things, even with, you know, you're doing really mainstream stuff at Marvel now. You know, you're on Silver Surfer, which is at one point a character Stan wouldn't let anybody do but himself. And not only is it this really fun book, but the female lead, again, is an all-red girl. She's dressed very cool. She's very hip. She's very almost, I'm trying to think of the best way to put it, but she is Minneapolis Uptown as a person, or, you know, whatever the cool part of town is where the artists hang out. And you've always had kind of, you've used hipsters and beatniks and stuff throughout your work. What is the draw to that sort of character and that sort of vibe for you?
I don't know. I've always kind of been a hippie at heart myself. Not a hipster, but hippie. You know, all zen and just, you know, trying to be at peace with myself so I can be at peace with others. And as far as fashion stuff, Laura is just naturally beautiful and able to know, you know, what flatters her but as far as the ideal woman, which kind of morphs from one female character to the next in all my comics, would be heavily influenced by Laura. And, you know, I always try to create the ideal woman for each of these characters. And, or in the case of iZombie, the lead character being a woman, wanting this ideal woman that you can identify with, that you want to spend time with, that is attractive, but relatable. And for me, that's Laura. So I always kind of go to her for that inspiration.
And she's been your colorist for a long time. Did she jump into it? Now you're bringing in boxes of comics. Did she kind of get into it, or was she rolling her eyes and going, oh, we're going to need an extra bedroom?
There were a few things that she got really excited about. Like a lot of the European stuff, Mobius, Daniel Torres, she was really drawn to. She really liked Dan Klaus's stuff and loves Love and Rockets. And the brothers personally, too, we're just very fond of all of them. Went to Mario's wedding. And, just think the world of them. And, you know, you got your friends, acquaintances, and peers, and then you got your hugging friends. They're hugging friends. So like whenever we see Gilbert or his wife, Carol, it's like there's just a lot of affection there. This is kind of the stuff that Laura was really drawn to and excited about. So in general, she was never that excited. And every once in a while, there'd be something that would get her excited, like the books I just mentioned. And then with Caliber, when we got the first opportunity to do something in color, now she's obviously an artist too. She was taking art classes at college with me. And then when we had this opportunity, it was just natural for her to step in and color it, especially since, it's not a secret, but I'm colorblind, I think the most correct way to describe it is I'm color deficient. I have a really hard time telling some colors apart. But my brain can learn colors. Like if a guy comes in here and he's wearing a dark blue shirt, and my brain doesn't know if it's purple or blue, or it could be a blue green. And then when somebody tells me this is kind of like a reddish purple, you know, then my brain goes click, 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 click. And then whenever I see that color again, my brain knows what the color is, but initially I can't tell what it is. The Christmas colors, red and green, if they're right next to each other, like on a wreath, the red berries and the green, they look a similar value to me. And so my brain has to like up, 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 and kind of zoom it and separate it. But it's absolutely virtually impossible to look at swatches, you know, on a computer and go, that's that color and that's that color. And so it would just never be practical for me to be a comic book colorist. I would have to have Laura standing behind me the whole time going, and that's yellow, and that's green, that's a yellow green. So fortunately for me, she's got this great color sense and is my favorite colorist. And I always love seeing how she takes what I do and, you know, sprinkles magic dust on it and makes it look really good. So I'm really lucky with that. But it all started with graphic music, just out of necessity, really. And then she, with that success, she then got really interested and now looks for stuff that excites her and her, also her sensibilities kind of had that fashion forward retro thing too, where she's drawn to classic flat colors. We like to, like people will refer to our stuff as retro or pop art. We like to think of it as classic or timeless, something that will be just as cool 50 years from now as it is today, you know. And also for us, it's all about the storytelling. What benefits the story? And sometimes when you keep things really simple, you have a purity, and the story doesn't get lost in a bunch of muck or special effects or what have you. Just have really pure, simple, strong, classic feel to it. And that's what excites us, and that's our main goal with everything we do.
I've always felt that your work is more about the story than the flash, and that's always been something that I've enjoyed. Now, going back to Spider-Man, I think your first work at Marvel was actually one of the Untold Tales of Spider-Man.
Yeah,
specials.
With Kurt Busiek. Yeah, and Joe Sinnott inked me on that. That was a dream come true.
So did that kind of tickle the back of your fanboy brain when you're like, I'm working on Spider-Man, seeing as how Spider-Man was kind of a big deal to you when you were a kid?
Oh, it's huge. Yeah, it meant everything. To be asked, to be allowed to do that, to tie in with the classic Marvel era through Joe Sinnott and Kurt had this great story. It was really exciting. I'd love to do stuff like that again, just to, but I think, I think the stuff I love the most is the stuff that took me to this world in the first place when I was a child. And so I like having this mix of doing my own work. Like I've got a 25th anniversary Madman special in front of me for next year. And then I've got a new creator-owned project called X-Ray Robot, which I'm working on in my, you know, air quote, spare time. But to be able to, you know, like for instance, I've been the official cover artist on these, you know, Adam West Batman books.
Yes.
I'm inking John Steed and Mrs. Peel and Batman and Robin for that series. So I do the covers for that. And I'm finishing a Batman 66 one-shot, doing all the artwork for that with the story my brother Lee wrote. I can't tell you exactly who they're teaming up with, but it will blow your mind. Just mark my words, when it's announced who they're teaming up with for this one-shot, it is like, yes, why isn't anybody else ever thought of that? So it's really cool. And then, of course, we did the last issue of the regular series, which told the tale of the Batman main titles, which were on the TV show. So it's just fun playing with – there's so many characters from my childhood that still exist today, and I still have huge affection for that I want to get my hands on. And to be able, again, to work on this stuff with these great writers, and like now doing Silver Surfer with Dan Slott and Tom Brevoort as our editor, it's it's electric. It feels very gratifying. There's just endless enthusiasm for it. And I don't feel like we're treading old ground. I feel like, you know, we're being very progressive and exciting and fresh with it. Yet it still taps into that great affection that comes from this, you know, love from that pure childhood perspective. And that's really important to me to keep that perspective in what I do. And that's why I love doing these, you know, classic characters and, you know, in Marvel and DC and what have you.
I would be deficient if I didn't ask about X-Statics and you taking over X-Force, because at the time it was such a huge shift. Here's a book that created by Rob Liefeld. 10 years later, you and Peter Milligan are doing something very, very different with it.
Yeah.
And of course, there's always, I'm about to step into an X-Men book. How did that come about? How were you pitched for that? Or did you pitch that to Marvel?
Oh, no, it was one of these, you know, happy accident, fun times kind of thing. Joe Quesada and I kind of came up at the same time, and we'd see each other at, you know, shows. And I remember we were in Chicago, and a mutual friend of ours had put this gallery together. Like, Alex Ross was there, and Joe and I, the woman that put this exhibit together, had additional art like at her apartment, and she was like, "Do you guys want to come see that too?" And we're like, and Joe and I kind of looked at each other like, "Ooh, she's inviting us to see her etchings." You know, like we were going to take it up to like something untoward was going to happen, but it was just a joke. But I just remember that with Joe and like having, you know, this really great night, just looking at all this terrific art and everything, and you know, admiring the success that he was enjoying, and it was just a really good time. The whole era where it was around the same time that Legend was happening. And in fact, that might be why I was in Chicago in the first place, one of these Legend events, but, at the comic book convention there. But, when he became the editor in chief at Marvel, I read an interview with him or something about what his intentions were. And it just sounded like it was just going to be the best time, like a big party. This enthusiasm he had for the potential. And keep in mind, Marvel came really close to going under right before that.
Oh, and, yeah, they were still in bankruptcy.
Yeah, so it was a really weird time. But it also gave Joe unprecedented freedom. It was like, you know, you can't break what's broke. And so Joe just kind of had this great enthusiastic plan. And so I just called him up and was like, "Man, if there's anything you think I might be right for, this just sounds like way too much fun. So if you can think of anything, count me in." He's like, "Oh, that's great to hear." So within the hour, like Tom Brevoort called me and Axel Alonso called me, and we're just kind of, they were pitching ideas at me, which had never happened up to that point in my career, where anybody was like, "Here's a menu, you know, what would you like?" And just all these fun ideas. And Axel had a pitch from Peter Milligan at the time, which I think they had kind of worked out together. Like they were just, you know, out drinking or something. And they just kind of, you know, batted this back and forth. At like the celebrity, you know, mutant concept. And I had done a Shade story with Peter. He's one of my favorite writers. He did a lot of stuff with Brendan McCarthy, which remains some of my favorite comics ever. And so right then when Axel mentioned Peter, I was, I perked up. And then when he said, "But the the big challenge here is going to be you're going to have to design a whole new batch of X-Men, a whole new batch of Marvel mutants. And he said it in a way like it was a bad thing or it was going to be some kind of burden. And I was like, wait. You're talking square one, all brand new characters? And he's like, oh, yeah. And that was it. So that's what I want to do. I want to do that. And then during that initial phone conversation and then several after that, I would just doodle while we were talking. And Axel's one of these editors. Shelley Bond's the same way, very much a collaborator and, in fact, co-creator in many ways. Axel was very much a co-creator with us on our version of X-Force Ecstatics, and because he was pitching ideas in there with us, and then we would, you know, Peter and I would knock it around, and then you'd see what the result was. That was really exciting, and like Shelley Bond and is very much a co-creator of iZombie and Art Ops. It's just the honest thing to say because she's throwing, you know, these creative ideas out there and helping us form characters and concepts, and it's really unique to have an editor that throws in like that. But and that's very much how Axel was. And so we were just alive with it and weren't thinking about, you know, Rob's fan base or any of that kind of stuff, because we were just thinking, well, you know, we're not taking that away. We're creating something new. And then, of course, that naive thought was shattered as soon as that first issue came out. And a lot of stuff happened with that. Of course, the people who were expecting to see the regular characters just all of a sudden they're not there anymore. And it was like, issue number 116 or something like that. So it's not like we started renumbering. We just continued the numbering and like, wait, where did the other guys go? These guys are here now. And then there was this extremely violent event that takes place. One thing I forgot to mention that Axel told me that I would be, not only would I be creating all new characters, but I'd be killing most of them off in the first issue. So, and that's exactly what happened. And the way Peter wrote it, it was very graphic and horrific. And that appealed to me in a way like, you know, if these horrible things are happening, I want the reader to feel them. And so I didn't pull back. And, you know, broken bones and blood and guts and everything. And again, you're just kind of in this creative, you know, the curl of this wave. And you're not thinking about any of this outside stuff. And when we finished that first issue, I then got a call from Joe and from Axel telling me that the Comics Code had rejected the book. And I was like, and right then I'm like, what? Because that, you know, I'd mostly been working independently up to this point and was never thinking about, it was always about the story. It was never about standards and practices or what was appropriate or not appropriate. For me, it was what was appropriate was the story and what the story needed to be told. And I'm very aware of like what kids should and shouldn't see and all that kind of stuff. But I'm also of the mind that as a parent, I'm very well aware of what I want my kids to see and not see and that sort of thing myself. So for me, I wasn't thinking Comics Code Authority or any of that kind of stuff. It was an entity I knew it existed. The stamp was on the books my entire life. But the next thing they told me was, and by the way, we're telling them to stuff it. We're not using them anymore. It's ridiculous. And we're not going to use the stamp anymore. And I was like, wow. And so this became the, we essentially killed the Comics Code Authority, and then soon after that, everybody else, it just fell away with everybody else too. So that was thrilling to know that we had that kind of support, because normally you would expect to, like, I remember once, panties had to be drawn on a woman in a Vertigo book that I did, which I thought was odd. You think Vertigo, and like, whoa, it wasn't showing anything graphically, but for whatever reason, the production department drew these black panties on this female character that was otherwise nude. But she was sitting down, and you knew she was nude, but you couldn't see anything. So that was the only other time I remember dealing with any kind of censorship, and to hear being told, oh, this has been rejected, but guess what? So what? You know, I'm thinking I'm going to have to black everything out and make everything silhouetted or whatnot, but I never had to worry about it for more than 10 seconds, because they immediately told me that, hey, but guess what? This is the end of an era. We're not going to use the code anymore. And we went from there, and then completely felt liberated to go forward with that. And we had these characters that were like, there was a hands-off policy on some, because a lot of the characters were killed regularly throughout the series. And we had some that like, no, you can't kill that one. You can't kill that one. These are the precious ones. And then we probably, the next most controversial thing we did was agree to kill one of our hands-off characters, which was, you know, Yugo Girl, Edie Sawyer. And it was devastating, and I knew what it felt like from the other standpoint, with Gwen Stacy. You know, you often take for granted that these characters are very important to people, that if you're lucky enough to have that kind of power over your readership, to where they actually care about these fictional characters that you've created and are writing and drawing, there's a responsibility that comes with that. And so whenever something tragic or horrible happens to, you know, a character, if somebody doesn't like what happens to them, I would want them to know that it's something I don't take for granted, that I do take it very seriously, and it is about feeling the weight of something and you know, having consequences because of it. So it isn't a gimmick or there isn't a callous casualness to it. There is a lot of soul and sincerity and heart behind, you know, all the comics that I try to make and be a part of. But that was fun. It's always fun when people bring that up, and it's weird because it wasn't a huge hit when we were doing it. Initially, it was. It was like I think top 10. It was at least top 20, and which I definitely the biggest selling. That and a Spider-Man Iron Man story I did with Brian Michael Bendis. First times I ever cracked the top 20 for sure. I'd never been a big seller or anything, and that was a weird thing to realize, that, you know, you're playing in this bigger field. But at the same time, that was just that initial, because they had a big X-Men month, and so all of the X-Men books, new X-Men came out around the same time. So it was, they were all beautifully promoted and were very successful, but then ours quickly found its numbers down in the mid to lower end of the top 100. But since it ended, it's kind of built this kind of legendary status, which is really nice, that it's gotten this new appreciation, and then even got even more of that when the omnibus was published. And And reading the reviews, seeing how people regarded it now, with this new appreciation that if it existed while it was being published, it wasn't to where I heard the appreciation beyond the the few loyalists that we did hear from.
And personally, thank you for not killing Dupe.
He can't be killed, technically.
Well, thank goodness.
I think all reality would disappear if Dupe disappeared. But and that was a fluke, man. Have you heard how Dupe came about?
No, I have not.
Well, he came into existence in one of these doodle sessions while I was on the phone with Axel. And was just drawing these, and I think the doodle is in the, I think it's published in the Omnibus collection in the back. But I just kind of drew this, this flying potato with little arms, and then I just wrote a word balloon over his head that said Dupe. And and then when I sent that in, Axel then came back and were like, We like the designs of this and this and this and this, but not sure about this Dupe guy. And I was like, oh, it was just stream of consciousness. It's just a joke. You know, not seriously proposing he'd be a character or anything. And this illustration was pinned up in the offices. And then Axel called me again, like the next day or soon after, and said, okay, I'll admit when I'm wrong, but everybody's running around the office going, Dupe, Dupe. And I think we might have something here. And so, and then from there, Peter went about instilling these infinite powers in him. And now it's argued that Dupe may be the most powerful character in the Marvel universe. So, from the lowest expectations, you never know.
And I want to talk a little about how that's one of those books that it kind of got canceled, but then over the years it became more and more popular. You've got another book like that you're probably pretty happy about, and that's iZombie.
Yeah.
Where it came out, and I remember loving it and even talking about it on the regular comic podcast we do. You people have to buy this. And it kind of faded off in sales. But now it's a hit TV show.
Yeah.
What was the genesis of iZombie?
That was Shelley Bond is actually the first editor I ever had. She was the editor for Steve Siegel and I on Jaguar Stories for Kimiko. And so this first paying gig that I had, she was our editor. And then when Kimiko went Chapter 11, Shelley ended up at, her name was Shelley Roberg at the time. She then ends up at DC working with Karen Berger with the new Vertigo imprint. And then she marries this cool British artist named Philip Bond and becomes Shelley Bond. And we just stayed in touch. She, in fact, the initial wave of proposals that I sent out before anything was published, I got a wave of rejection letters, and I got one from Kimiko, you know, and these are your standard blah, 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 you know, but then written in hand at the bottom was Shelley saying, I'm really disappointed that we didn't pick this up because I really love what I'm seeing here. Please stay in touch. Show me everything that you ever do. And it was one of the most encouraging things I heard when I was, you know, seriously trying to get something published. And she's since become just one of our, you know, most special friends and just really close and spent a lot of time with her. So she was always trying to get me to, you know, have stuff to do at Vertigo. And so I did the Brother Power of the Geek special. She hooked me up with Peter Milligan for that first Shade story that I did. Karen was more responsible for me doing the Sandman that I did with Neil Gaiman, but Shelley was always this cheerleader at DC and Vertigo. And I ended up doing a few issues of Fables. So off and on, I would just always kind of, we'd find stuff that we could do together. And then she was always encouraging me to send in proposals, or she would show me proposals that had come in that were looking for somebody to develop, you know, and design characters and co-create different things. And that's what iZombie was, where she said, you got to see what Chris Roberson is proposing. I'd like to see what you think about it, what your ideas on it would be. And I looked at it and was like, ooh, this could be really cool. And so I sent back what I would like to do with it. And, for instance, making the lead, I wanted a comic book character that character that looked like Debbie Harry, for instance. I can't remember how Chris originally described her and whatnot, but that would be one of the things that was in my, when, you know, when I came back with, you know, so you're volleying back and forth, like, what if we did this, or what if it was this instead of that, or ooh, I really love that, and we should really push that. And it was a lot of this, and so Shelley, Chris, and I were just knocking this stuff around, and it originally was going to be what the TV series actually is. It was going to focus on, each issue would be the story of whatever brain she consumes, and then she would take on those properties and memories and whatnot. But then we just got super ambitious, and Chris created this whole idea of the undersouls and oversouls, and why these monsters are created, and how these monsters are these kind of creatures. And it just became this huge creature feature kind of series for us, where we did our versions of every kind of monster you could think of. And at the center was our zombie girl. And so that's really how that came about. But we just got super ambitious beyond that. And then I think that ambition is, bringing in the dead presidents and just world building like crazy, that it kind of built towards this huge epic, intergalactic climax. It did well enough. But not to where we'd be thinking, well, let's do a few hundred issues, or, you know, Fables numbers, or, you know, how many issues did Fables eventually do, or Sandman?
150. 150 okay. For Fables.
Yeah, and Sandman was initially 70-something.
75.
It became clear to us that we probably weren't going to, you know, to do as many issues, and so we just built towards this huge epic conclusion. And then somehow, you know, Rob Thomas and Diane Ruggiero, they saw something that could be a TV series there, and with we get this phone call from Jeff Johns, and I think initially we were at a show together, and he's like, hey, can we meet for breakfast? And like, yeah, sure. And Jeff's always been really nice. He's always he's always liked Madman, and has always said nice, encouraging things, which is, you know, when people you admire saying nice things about what you do, it's always a nice pat on the back that makes you want to work a little harder and, you know, up your game. And Jeff was always one of those guys for us. So at breakfast, he just says, you know, this is just a maybe, but there's some interest in iZombie. And we're like, yeah, right. Whatever. You know, no, nothing else. I mean, nobody had made a Sandman movie or TV show or, you know what I mean? It was like nothing else.
And when you think network TV, A Girl Who Eats Brains.
No.
It's not the first thing that pops into your head.
No, or anything. And keep in mind, it took decades to you have the Batman TV show, and then you got to wait over 10 years for the Superman movie, and then another, you know, 10 plus years for the Tim Burton Batman movie. And so you'd never think that what we see happening the past, you know, 8-10 years would be happening. that not only would comic book properties become more regular, but be good. Like,
yeah,
quality, exciting, life-affirming entertainments. And at this point, you know, a few years ago, so as we're seeing the success of the Iron Man film and, you know, and the Marvel Universe is really taking off, and the Batman, you know, the Dark Knight did really well, and you could argue about the, you know, the relative success of these other comic book properties. You know, Hellboy did pretty good. Sin City was the most faithful of comic book adaptations. And so it's a crapshoot, and you know the odds are against you that not only will, and keep in mind, I've had Madman optioned for a film since 1995 when Universal Pictures first picked it up. And like nonstop, it's been optioned until just this last year. So for me to know that the step from having something optioned and actually produced is a huge leap. It's always fun to think about, and it's, you know, an option check is a nice thing to get, but for me, you can't help but build a certain level of protective skepticism.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, this is great, fun, whatever. And then, but then I get a phone call from Jeff. Oh, it looks like this is happening. And then, okay, all right. And then next thing you know, it's like, you know, you want to come meet these people and you want to do this and you want to do that. And you start trying to decide, you know, what do I want to participate in and what do I want to have a wait and see mode in? Do you want to do the opening title sequence for the show? And, you know, it's like, up until actually seeing the first episode, I still had that healthy, protective, you know, barrier. And I'm watching it and I'm like, this is really good. Rose MacIver, for instance, wow. This is such a, you know, wonderful playground for her, and to subtly change her personality with each brain, and the magical chemistry with the cast, and the really fun, innovative stories and fun. It's a fun show. And I'm really proud that, you know, speaking for Chris, you know, I don't like speaking for other people, but I think I can safely say, so the same way that I do, that we're proud to have our name on that thing. And so it's a really nice, good time. And we have iZombie Night, you know, we do what we call a family dinner. Our friends and family get together once a week, and iZombie Night has kind of become our regular meeting time, whether the show's on or not anymore. And it's been a great ride.
Well, as we wrap up, I'd like to talk a little about the Silver Surfer.
Let's do.
Again, as I said a little earlier, Silver Surfer, I remember when I was a kid, there was the, no one gets to write the Silver Surfer but Stan.
Mm-hmm.
And out of all the characters, that was the one he kind of held dear until like the late 80s, when it's okay, we'll let someone else do it, but Stan will still do Silver Surfer stories, including one with Mobius.
Oh, yeah.
So was it intimidating to step into those shoes, knowing that while the character hasn't been, you know, hugely successful over the last few years, it still has this place in people's hearts?
Yeah, he's very much a cult figure. We Silver Surfer fans are a weird group, but it was another wonderful right place at the right time kind of situation. Matt Fraction and his wife Kelly Sue are friends of ours. They're fellow Oregonians. We end up at the same you know, birthday parties and karaoke parties, and it's a kind of thing where, hey, we should do something together. And then Matt comes to me and says, would you like, I'm going to do 16 issues of FF. You want to jump in? And like, that actually sounds like fun. So when I hear FF, you know, I should say my all-time favorite comics ever are the Fantastic Four comics that Jack Kirby drew. You know, just, it was just this tidal wave of creativity that, you know, I could point at the Barry Smith Conan run or whatnot, but it's rare when you just see somebody just all cylinders. I mean, the Inhumans, Black Panther, of course, Silver Surfer, it's just on and on and on, all these epic adventures. And of course the Galactus trilogy would be my single favorite of all of those. And it has been my whole life, really. In fact, one of my earliest memories is the cartoon of the show. You know, you look at it now and it's just really cheap and not beautifully done. But for a young mind to, you know, see these characters and this situation and this world eater coming and then this silver dude on a surfboard saving the day, you know, going up against his master. And then I have just seeing so many different variations of the, you know, the collections. Like it'll be in a Fantastic Four collection. Like in the '70s, there'd be these, I forget who the publisher was, but they were
Treasury editions. And then there was Fireside did those collected books too.
Fireside was what I was initially talking of. There's like, I have the Fireside Fantastic Four that has, you know, a mix of stuff, but the Galactus trilogy is in there. It has a painted cover, and then, like you said, the big Treasury edition. And so again and again and again, the Galactus trilogy is coming at me and coming at me and coming at me, and just keeps reinforcing that this is my all-time favorite single story in comics. So I hear FF and I'm like, yes, the First Family. And so I'm like all in, you know, absolutely. And then for a split second, I'm disappointed because I'm told, oh, and by the way, you're not going to be doing Reed Richards, Sue, Ben, Johnny. It's going to be this whole other group over here. And I'm like, oh, okay. and then he says, and they're going to be led by Ant-Man. And then all of a sudden I'm like through the roof again, because he's just one of my favorite characters. And then again, just like with X-Force, and we'd like to see you redesign the costumes and, you know, do your take on all this stuff. So I'm like, so you have that wonderful carrot of have fun with it, you know, that, which is, if you want me to be excited about anything that I'm doing, tell me that I'm going to have fun with it. And I'm on for the races, but it was a blast. And then, Matt got pulled in different directions, and my older brother Lee is literally a genius. And no exaggeration, just brilliant. And fortunately, he uses his intellect for good over evil. I think sometimes he uses it for evil, but he hasn't hurt anybody yet. But with this brilliant brain of his is also this. The only person I've ever met that. Well, there's a couple people that could rival this encyclopedia, you know, history of comics. He knows everything, who did what, who met who wrote it, who drew it. It's insane. Tom Brevoort is one of these guys that can do that. And Mark Waite, who I was actually in that trivia contest with once, was like, are you kidding me? How do you know that? well, Lee's like that. So I suggested Lee to round out the 16 issue series, and Tom was cool with that, especially when Lee, you know, said, here's how I would, because we had a pretty specific outline from Matt, and so we knew how to, that we had to get, you know, hit point A, B, C, D, whatever, but Lee had this really wide berth for filling in all the other blanks and just went crazy with it, with this beautiful, epic ass whooping on Dr. Doom that, you know, that he's never suffered before, and from Ant-Man of all people. And so that was a blast. And as this is coming to an end, I hear from Tom, and he asks me, would you at all be interested in doing Silver Surfer? And it is like Bugs Bunny when he says, "You don't know me very well, do you?" You know, it's like, I just could not, you know, it's like another one of those pinch me moments. Really? Are you kidding me? Of course. He told me how, you know, with Dan, that they were on one of these retreats the whole group was trying to figure out what to do with Silver Surfer. And, I guess none of the pitches were getting taken. And then Tom just, you know, off along with Dan, asks him, "What would you do?" And Dan gave him his pitch with this companion and this opportunity to really humanize Norrin and make him as relatable as possible. And Tom was like, "Let's do that." And what would you think of, you know, Michael Allred drawing it? And I'm hearing this secondhand from them, you know, and they're both telling me that once Tom suggested me, that it had ruined anybody else for it. That was very flattering, that knowing that Dan absolutely had to get me to be the one to draw it. And our relationship has only gotten better since then. I cannot over exaggerate how much I love Dan Slott. I love the way his brain works. Every time I get new plot pages, it's just thrilling. And there's always stuff that challenges me and excites me and reinvigorates me. And that's what Silver Surfer has done for us. And we did the issue number 11, where they're in this time loop, and then you fold the pages to break through the time loop, and everybody was telling us, "Oh, this is going to win awards and all this kind of stuff." And you get told that from very overly kind people throughout the years. And oftentimes you're disappointed because then it doesn't happen. But this time it did. Silver Surfer, of all things, nominated for Best Continuing Series, Best Single Issue. Laura for colorist, me for, you know, penciler, inker. For Silver Surfer, you know, which you wouldn't think would get that kind of recognition. So it's very humbling and very encouraging, and just makes all of us want to just, you know, keep having fun with it. And that's what it's been for us, just this very invigorating, fulfilling experience.
I want to thank you for taking the time. We could talk comics all night. We really could. It's been a joy talking with you.
Well, I wish I'd let you talk more.
Oh, that's okay. I have my own podcast where I talk all the time.
Okay. Yeah, that's the one thing, talking about, if you get me talking about movies or comics or music, and you can't shut me up, and it can be embarrassing sometimes. So thank you for indulging me.
Where can people follow your work at, other than going to the comic shop, picking up those omnibuses of iZombie and Ecstatics? And currently on the Silver Surfer, you've got the covers of Batman 66 you're doing. Where can people follow you online?
I have a website, AAAPOP.com, AAAPOP.com. Facebook pages. One is Laura's page, which is Michael versus Laura Allred on Facebook. The Twitter is @ AllredMD. @ AllredMD is also the Instagram. Back in my day.
All these things.
But the AAA Pop website isn't that active, but there is a gallery page where is a nice representation for the majority of my careers, where you'll have examples of, I think, covers of most everything I did and stuff like that. And also, oh, the most fun thing about AAAPop.com in that gallery page, at the top it says world's great biggest comic book panel. And issue number 9 of Madman Atomic Comics was one continuous tracking shot. So this big action shot that just goes, you know, throughout the entire issue. And here you can see it in the comic. It's double pages, you know, double page spread. But here you can see it all uncut. So it's, you can scroll across the entire thing, making it's just one gigantic comic book panel. And so I always like pointing people there so they can see it, you know, completely unbroken.
That was an amazing issue.
Thank you.
Well, thank you again, and I hope you can keep up on your deadlines, because you've been inking while we've been talking.
Yeah, so far so good.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
And that is Mike Allred. We didn't even get to talk about the kind of old comics that we enjoy. I probably will have another episode like that. I'm finding more and more where I just enjoy talking old comics with anybody. But like with the interview with Angel Medina, he actually said, I thought we were just going to talk old comics and wrestling. So who knows? Maybe we'll go in that direction in the future. It's been a busy month. We got a lot of episodes dropping. Tomorrow is the return of Novelcast. That's right. Novelcast has moved to Fridays. Solitaire Rose Novelcast is where I take the novels that I have written and turn them into audiobooks, and they will eventually be turned into ebooks. You can find that over at novelcast.solitairerose.com. There's also the weekly news update, which is the only news parody podcast that has been blocked on Twitter by Donald Trump, and that's weeklynewsupdate.solitairerose.com. There's also the Crazy Comics and Stories every Monday. There's a lot going on, a lot coming up. We will be appearing at conventions. I actually had a meeting last night with Dangerous Dan Moore putting together a convention schedule. If you want me to come to a convention near you, or you are working on a convention, go ahead, send me an invitation, send me information at solitairerosenetwork@gmail.com. We want to show up at conventions. I had a lot of fun doing the live stream, and we want to be doing it at more conventions. We want to show up. We want to show what it's like at the convention, and of course, I'm stupid enough that I will talk the entire time. People who aren't stupid are our sponsors. They are right here. Believe it or not, kids, this silliness has actual real sponsors. Our first sponsor is Graze.com. Graze gives you healthy snacks sent to your house. You can have them delivered weekly, bi-weekly, monthly, and your first box is free if you use the code CORYS3R5B. Our second sponsor is Bombas. Bombas socks are some of the best socks in the world, and remember, for every pair you buy, they donate a pair to a homeless shelter or other worthy cause. Just go to bombas.gotocloud.org/SF30. That's right. Those are our ads. Go check out our sponsors. I want to thank you for listening. Please spread the word. It is how podcasts grow. Retweet us. Share the link on Facebook. Give us reviews on iTunes. It helps with the people knowing more about us. Tell every single human being you've ever met in your life about the podcast, because the more attention we get, the better we do, the healthier the podcast will be, and the more I can do this. I want to thank you again for listening, and we'll be back soon with more stories. Ow! Spine podcast from Solitaire Rose Networks.
The end.